get to know the artists behind the epic melodies, songs, and beats. Celebrating the best new music from around the world. This is the A State of Trance Podcast.
Hey, what's up? My name is Ruben de Ronde in the studio with Nina de Koning.
Hello.
And very special guest today, Rich, aka Solarstone.
Hi.
I've been looking forward to this moment. Because whenever we meet, we have nice chats. So I'm pretty sure that this is going to turn out as a nice little chat as well.
Okay, I'll try not to swear.
No, you can do that. You can do that. No worries.
So today we're going to dive a little bit into the history of Solarstone. Correct me if I'm wrong, starting back in 1996 or even earlier, because you started as a trio with Sam and Andy.
God, yeah. Do you know what? No one's asked me about this for ages.
Well, there you go.
Can I tell you something first?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Last night, I had this dream that I was coming to the State of Trance studio, not to do a guest mix, but to have a bath.
A bath?
Yeah, and I was in the bath.
Well, let me tell you, underneath the desk. No.
I was in the bath, and then you were like, okay, time to come. And I was like, I don't have a towel, and I couldn't find a towel anywhere.
There you go. That's what I meant with this is going to be an interesting podcast.
Yeah. So yeah, we did start as a trio. Well, I met Andy, and then he introduced me to Sam, and we were originally called the Space Kittens.
Space Kittens.
Space Kittens. And we released our first record in 1995, and it was an EP on our own label.
Yeah.
Called Sunflower Vibes, the label was called. And we sent a copy of it to Pete Tong, and he played two of the tracks on the Essential Selection.
Yeah.
And then the phone started ringing, and everybody wanted to sign these tracks, and we signed one of them to Huge Tunes. And then the following year, we did a load of remixes as a Space Kittens. We did remixes for on labels like East West and Perfecto and loads of stuff like that.
As the Space Kittens.
As the Space Kittens, yeah. We did remixes for Grace and Lisa Moorish, like Mr. Friday Night and all kinds of stuff, Perfecto Fluoro. And then we did this new track, which was called The Calling, which we sent to the label, Huge Tunes, and they said, you need a new name for this.
Because they were not feeling Space Kittens
anymore.
Because
the sound was very different. Like Space Kittens was like acid disco, and then it sort of started becoming like Goa Trance, which was kind of mental.
Yeah.
And Jerry Dickens from Huge, he said, you need a new name for this, guys. So you need to have a think about it. So we had to think about it. We couldn't think of anything at all. And he called us up one day and he said, right, guys, look, we're doing the artwork for this new single, so you need a name. And if you can't think of a name, I'm going to name you The Pleasure Tendency, which we thought was ridiculous, but actually thinking about it now, it's actually probably tendency. Better than Solarstone.
Does it really?
So so we were there and we had to think of a name. So we had this book in the studio and I don't remember who it was, but we flicked through the book and pointed at a page and whatever was on the page, that was going to be the name of the group.
Yeah.
And it was a Egyptian hieroglyph thing of a guy pointing to an asteroid or a comet in the sky, and it was called the Solar Stone.
And there you go.
And that's where the name came from. But you didn't even ask me where we got the name.
No. Well, nice that you explain it anyway. But
yeah. And so here we are, like 25 years later or something, with this ridiculous name, Solar Stone.
Well, to be honest, if I compare Space Kittens to Solar Stone.
Yeah.
Which is more silly?
Yeah, they're both equally silly, really. It's funny because when I play at events, I always see like nearly every artist has got just use their name, don't they? Like you use
like
Ruben Durand, Armin van Buuren.
Yeah.
And then you have me with this Solar Stone, and I kind of think, ooh, you know, I think, I might, you know, do I sound
a lot of people
about 15?
Call you just Rich Solar Stone. Maybe they think it's your last name.
When I check into hotels sometimes when I'm touring, then I'm like, Richard Mowat, no, nothing there. Mowat, no. And then I go, oh, it's Solar Stone, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mr. Solar Stone, welcome.
Yeah. I want to go back a little bit before Space Kittens all started, because what was the moment that you started making music? Because this is different times. Like making music back in those days, excuse me, but nowadays it's just that you have your computer, that's it. But back in the days with making music, that was very complicated.
I started making music in earnest when I was in my early 20s, and I was in a band. I got a job in a pub, and I met a couple of guys in the pub called Jay and Stu. Mm-hmm. And it was around like 1990, maybe.
Yeah.
1991. And it was the time when sort of indie dance was just starting. Acid House had happened, and then you had people like Pop Will Eat Itself and EMF, who did Unbelievable. Remember that one?
And I wish I did, but I don't.
You do?
Yeah, I do. I do. Yeah. You're unbelievable.
Oh, you know, okay. Yeah. Oh, there you go. Yeah. Thinking, Nina. Yeah.
It's a classic.
It is a classic. Yes. It was around that time. So we started making this sort of, well, I had a keyboard and I'd program all the music. And then Jay was a brilliant guitarist. And yeah. we had this mental frontman, Stu, who was really like, wrote really good songs. So we started performing and doing gigs and stuff, and we did some cool gigs, and we released a 7-inch single, and we had, and that was in 93, I think.
Okay.
And we had t-shirts and stuff like that, and I still got one of the t-shirts. We were called Emission, and our name was typed in Helvetica, which is the same font that I use now for Solar Stone. And we released one single, and then I sent a copy of the single to a pirate radio station where Andy from Solar Stone was working, and I sent him the single, and he said, oh, I love Emission, I come to your gigs.
Yeah.
And so he came to one of my gigs, and then Emission split up, which I'm not going to go into why. And So the guitarist Jay, his dad had quite a successful business, a foundry, like where they would, you know, stamp metal and stuff. And
yeah.
it was his own company. And I think his dad said to him something like, look, Jay, you need to make a decision. You're either going to run the family business or you're going to do this band thing.
So he had to choose between.
Yeah. And yeah. we were actually doing quite well. We had our biggest gig ever at this big venue in Wolverhampton called the Wolfram. And we were supporting a band called Ned's Atomic Dustbin, who were like a top 40 act. And there were people there from record labels and stuff to see us. And just before we went on stage, Jay said, by the way, guys, I'm leaving the band. So we did the gig, and Stu was really angry, the singer. And at the end, he went, this is our last fucking gig. Goodbye. And
you continued with Andy?
Yeah. And so then I'd met Andy by that point, and so he invited me around his house, and he had a little Amiga computer and a keyboard, and we did a track like in a day. And then he said, I know a guy called Sam who's got some equipment, and he had like a 909 and a Juno 106, and he had a computer.
Yeah.
And I'd never used a computer before that point.
Just samplers, just record stuff.
Well,
it's a live band though.
Yeah, I just had this keyboard, a Korg keyboard, and I used to program the thing. So people used to say to me, you should use a computer. And I'd be like, why? Because I didn't even know what a computer did.
Yeah.
And then Sam had a computer and he had all this equipment. And so we started working in his bedroom at his dad's house, you know, surrounded by KFC wrappers and beer bottles and all of us smoking spliffs or whatever.
Yeah.
And then we produced this first EP.
The Calling.
No, it was the Space Kittens.
Oh, just Space Kittens, okay, yeah.
And then 1996, then we did The Calling, and that came out on Huge, and it was Huge Tunes' 50th release.
Okay.
And it was number one in the Mixed Mag Club chart. And it was Essential New Tune on Pete Tong's Essential selection.
That was like the highest thing you can achieve as a dance music artist back then, I guess.
It was. I mean, getting Essential New Tune on Pete Tong's show was just, we were like, we'd arrived, you know?
Yeah.
We're
done.
Yeah, that's it.
We're set.
And then remixes started coming in and then, you know.
But
and
the thing is, like, in that day, you did arrive. Like, it was like people would know who you were and what you were doing. And now if you have like maybe like a million streams on Spotify or something like that, it still means you have to have a follow-up single. You have to have another follow-up single doing well.
It was so hard.
Yeah, but you would release a tune back then and it would be in the charts for half a year or something like that.
And you'd tease a track for months and months.
Yeah, but, you would play it in your sets and
But the label, Huge, Jerry was so fussy about everything we did, and it was such a laborious process. Like, you would spend a month working on a track and then you would send it down to Jerry on a DAT tape, and then it would take 2 weeks to listen to it. And because you were working in an analog studio, you had to leave everything. So we would literally be waiting for 2 weeks for the phone to ring. And then we'd get him on the phone. Yeah, I thought it was okay, but it needs to be better. And we'd be like, what do you mean better? Well, I don't know, just better. So you'd spend another 2 weeks, send another tape, and then
leave everything as it is.
Yeah. So you'd spend 2 months on a track, you know. And it was and then after that, I'd say no to the track. And it was just a nightmare. And it got to the point with Hooge where we did an album deal. This is after Sam had left and it was just me and Andy, and we signed this album deal, and they just weren't responding and they weren't interested in the music. And so we'd been given all this money, but we had a half an album and it was just all shelved. And it was only like years later that we were able to release those tracks. Things are definitely better now, even though it's harder to make a living in the music industry now in terms of producing music and releasing it. It's way, way more natural process. You know?
Yeah. Sam, you already mentioned Sam left in 1998.
Yeah. Sam just wasn't into the music. He was a brilliant producer, Sam. He still does some stuff, I believe. I think his artist name is Harvey Keitel.
Okay.
But he did some really great like drum and bass stuff and Goa Trance. But I say that, but Sam would spend 2 hours EQing a kick drum.
Mm-hmm.
While me and Andy were sitting there wanting to kill him. And he would do these things where, like, he'd mess around for ages and ages with the mix. And me and Andy would be sitting there, you know, Jesus Christ. And we'd like, okay, it sounds great, fine. And then we'd go out to get a beer and we'd come back and he would have changed it back. Why did he do that? And it was just a nightmare. And so when Sam said he was leaving, by the time Sam said he was leaving, I knew how to do all this, like, EQing and engineering. I was like, thank God, you know. Good riddance, because I just couldn't be doing
well. maybe you learned all of doing all that stuff because he was such a perfectionist that you could see what he was doing, right?
I used to watch him, you know, and even though it wasn't particularly, I mean, we had a mixing desk and two effects, so it was all EQing, you know, sweepable EQ and a reverb and a delay, and that was it. But I basically learned how to do all the stuff he did, so by the time he left, it was fine. You know, I don't wish him any, I mean, he was a nice guy, but I couldn't work with him in the studio again. Oh my God.
And after that, so Sam left, and after that, the tracks came along that really put Solarstone on a map globally, with Seven Cities, of course, 1999. Solar Coaster, 2000.
Yeah. Well, that was one of the ones. Solar Coaster was a track that was recorded in like a few days just for a bit of fun and was left on a DAT tape for like 4 years.
But I'm always wondering, where did you get that vocal from?
It's from True Romance, the movie.
Okay.
I tell you, it was proper serendipity. You know, as a producer, you're like,
it'd be really great if I had
a vocal sample here.
Yeah.
And I was working on the track and I had this lovely breakdown. I was thinking, it'd really be nice to have a good vocal sample. Went round to my friend Michelle's and we were watching True Romance. And I'd been saying to her, I really need a vocal sample for this track. And then at the end of the film, it comes on, you know, I look back and I'm amazed at my dreams. I just looked at her and went,
This is it. Yeah. And you managed to clear that, or?
No, don't be ridiculous. I've never cleared a sample in my life. I have one. Well, actually, When I Dream from the Island album, it's got this sample from an artist called Momus, who I was a massive fan of. And I use this sample. It's the bit that goes, When I Dream, do-do-do-do-do. And I was a massive Momus fan. He's this English, very eccentric avant-garde producer from the UK. And I emailed him and I said, hey, you know, I'm a massive fan. I would love to license the sample of this from you. And he said, fine, just use it. It's fine. I was like, don't you want anything? And he went, nah, it was only from a crappy sample CD from the 80s anyway. Just use it. It's fine. He said, I wouldn't, you know, I've never cleared a sample myself. So.
Okay. Well, there you go. You already told us that you didn't have the best relationship with Hooge. So in late 90s, you started a label together with Andy.
Well, Deep Blue
Recordings.
They were lovely people, don't get me wrong. But Jerry was just, he knew what he wanted. And he would, when he got bored of something, he would change. Like the direction of the label changed.
Leave everything behind, just focus on the next project.
And when you're an artist and you've built up a profile as making trance music, and then all of a sudden all he wants is fucking bongos.
Yeah.
You know, it's very frustrating.
Was that the reason why you started Deep Blue Recordings?
It was simply because we wanted to put make our music ourselves and release it ourselves.
Yeah.
And that's how I met Tim Stark, the guy who writes all the wonderful interviews and PR and
for
stuff.
DJ Mag for all these years.
Because he used to work for Amato and they were the distribution company in London. We went down there with the very first release on Deep Blue, which was I Want You by Z2. This was in 1999. And we went in there and he was sat there and he was a lot fatter then.
Yeah.
Tim was, and he was like, yeah, this is really great. But you'd only ever press like 1,000 copies then of a vinyl. You know, they never wanted to do any more than that. So you'd press 1,000 and then they'd sell out and they'd be like, okay, fine, move on to the next one. And you'd be like, let's press some more. No, let's put out another record. So Deep Blue started in 99 and We had Deep Blue Limited, Deep Blue Digital, Deep Blue International, like all these sub-labels. That's where my record label graveyard began.
Oh yeah, we'll get to that in just a little bit. But first on Deep Blue, because I was looking into the releases on there, I was like, oh, 2002, you started Young Parisians on there as well.
Yeah.
A new project with Andy because, you know, Solar Stone wasn't enough. No. So you started the Alias with You Write the Rules, Jump the Next Train.
Young Parisians, that was meant to be my sort of 80s thing. I was doing this sort of 80s sounding thing with me singing on it.
Yeah.
And we did You Write the Rules, which was a full vocal track. I don't know if you've ever heard the original version, but it's like a sort of half speed with a full song. And then we did a Solar Stone mix, and of course that's the one everyone played.
Yep.
And then Jump the Next Train, which started off as sort of like an 80s indie dance record, Solar Stone mix. Kiao and Albert did a mix.
Kiao and Albert mixes.
Just became another trance alias.
So you so there was an alias started as an 80s vibe, and then, you know, the trance communities took it and ran with it.
But I did release a new Young Parisians track last year. Or the year
2021.
Yeah, with Catherine Amy.
Rediscover. Is it something that you're going to bring back once again? Because,
yeah.
I mean, you're a good vocalist, so why not?
Ooh, well, I've got, me and Paula, we go around in circles with this because I'm quite, you know, with my own voice, I'm like, you know, I don't feel that comfortable singing, but some people...
Let's put some reverb behind it and the mic is yours.
Ooh, baby.
There you go.
Yeah, it's good.
I'm going to sample that because I don't have to clear anything with you. So I'll sample it and use it in one of my songs.
Jesus. Oh my God. But I do sing sometimes, but it's only, I don't write that many songs, but sometimes I write a song and I think I'm going to sing that one myself because I really mean the song.
Yeah.
So I've got a couple of songs and there's one for the next album that I've done. And there's, I wrote another one a few days ago, actually, in secret. Paula doesn't know, but it's based upon a little thing that I sing to my children to help them put them to sleep, which I'm not going to sing. No, don't you put the reverb on.
I tried, guy. I promise.
Yeah.
So, later on, you started more aliases, Liquid State and Z2.
Z2, that was the sort of, me and Andy, it was for the sort of darker, harder stuff.
Yeah.
So we did I Want You and we did some remixes. It wasn't much, actually. We did a
Z2 had a decent amount of releases. Like,
yeah, there was some Icano Run remix, Illuminatus Hope. There was a few things we did. I really love the Z2 sound. I mean, that, which was the one, the remix we did of Icano Run. I mean, they were all supported by everyone. Sasha, Nick Warren, John Digweed, everybody supported these records back then. They were all over the place.
But still, you decided to discontinue that and then...
Well, I split up with Andy, didn't I? And I felt I couldn't really... I don't know. I might bring it back. I don't know.
Yeah.
We'll see.
And another... I'm just jumping through your discography because there's just so much to talk about, but I want to keep it a little bit... We can make a show of 2 hours, to be honest. Because another thing that really stood out also for me as a massive vinyl collector, I have a lot of your stuff. And you brought to life Made in England in 2003 with Scott Bond.
Yeah, that's
the label.
Yeah, we kind of made friends with Scott and he wanted to make a track and we decided to set up our own label.
Because why not?
Yeah. The first one we did, Third Earth, we sold 5,000 copies of that, single-sided white label. We sold 5,000 copies of that to Hard to Find Records in Birmingham.
Yeah.
And they sold them all for a tenner. Unbelievable, right?
And then it was licensed in also because the one I have is, I think it's from ID&T.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you made Third Earth and then Naked Angel.
Redline Highway. Yeah. Scott was, we used to have a really good laugh with Scott. He always used to come around the studio with a bag of weed and sausage sandwiches. And then we would make a track. It was cool.
Is that something that you, are you still talking with him sometimes or is it just something that just, it's a past station and that's it?
I played for his rebooted thing in Sheffield a few weeks ago, which was good fun. We've talked about doing something else, but I like to move forward, you know.
Yeah.
I don't see the point in just going backwards and don't see the point of that.
Wasn't there, I just realized, wasn't there like a big remix contest for Naked Angel?
Oh, God.
I think I participated in that one also.
Did you? It was terrible. If you're an artist, never do a remix competition. Because we had, for Naked Angel, we did a remix competition. We had 100 entries. Oh my God.
One of them was mine.
A vocal that goes, oh. imagine hearing that over and over again. And so we released two vinyls with the winning entries. But do you know what? I ended up hating
not
that
one
track.
Of mine. No.
I ended up hating it. And I didn't know you had done an entry. I've still got all the cassettes at home in a bag.
I should have it. Yeah, you should.
Maybe
have it over.
Maybe release it still. Just
no,
like...
No. I promise you that one wasn't good.
Well, I
we
tell
all
you
want
what,
air it out.
Me and Andy, we did a deal with Armada a few years ago for some of our back catalogue. So a lot of our back catalogue is now owned and done by Armada. And Naked Angel is one of those tracks. And so if they were to do a pack of remixes, maybe Ruben could do one.
Yeah, well, I already did one, but I don't want to release it. So that's one of the things. I mentioned it here in the podcast many times before, because one thing, like back in the days when you start out making music like that, when you play it for your friends, they're all liars. Yeah. Because they all say it's fantastic. But it was garbage.
It could have been great. I mean, it could have been great.
But ever since, like back in those days.
How old were you then when you did that?
I have no idea.
But that was 2002, right?
And then I was 19. Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Wow.
So it wasn't good, I promise you.
But I ended up hating that record. But it's
such
only,
a good record, man.
I started playing it again this year, and I'm like, oh my God, what a great record.
Yeah.
But it took me 20 years to get over it, the remix.
So the remix competition just destroyed that tune for you.
Completely.
All right, let's jump on, because in 2005, you already said it, you have a graveyard of labels. You started out Solaris together with Nick Stonkov.
Not exactly. Solaris was a label that was set up by a guy I knew. It was a guy who basically bought a load of the Hooge Tunes back catalogue after the label went bust.
Yeah.
And he was a big Solar Stone fan, and he set up this label and he wanted me to make a track for it, which was Eastern Sea.
Okay.
And then I became a 50% kind of, I went into him.
All right.
It just didn't work out after that.
Some new music?
I went into John Pitcher and I became a partner in the label, and I think we did about 70 or 80 releases, but then our professional relationship stopped working, and so I walked away from that one.
Okay.
And put that one in the record label graveyard. And you're referring to Nick Stoinoff, but he was an artist who he was one of the artists on Molecule, which was another one of my labels.
Oh, that's true. Sorry. Molecule from 2010 to 2018. That was the one. Yeah.
Yeah. There was a very short-lived Molecule Sessions podcast thing, which Nick did, which is probably why you think that Nick Stoinoff was something to do with the label. But he was an artist on the label.
Okay.
He's from Chicago. Lovely guy. Great producer.
Yeah. Well, let's list some of the other labels. Crashing Waves, Feed the Moth.
Feed the Moth still exists. That's the label I have with the guys from Federation. Yeah, that's our label.
Okay. And then Insatiable
Records.
Yeah. Solar Swarm.
Solar Swarm Recordings was the world's
with
first
the community.
Social network record.
I remember
label.
That. You set it up a forum and people could submit anything and
shout
decide,
out to
decide
the
it themselves. Yeah.
You would have like demo drops or something like that?
We had a community of about 30 or 40 members, and people would look for demos on SoundCloud, and then somebody would upload it to the player on the website, and then everybody would vote in the forum on polls whether we should sign it, and then people would suggest
remixes.
That was
great. I remember that.
That's so cool.
Actually, I did a gig in San Diego last weekend, and I met up with two of the Solar Swarmers, Matt Maestro and Josh the Bear. And we had a really nice time that night. And I'm just signing something from Josh now.
Fantastic.
Oh, wow.
After all these years. Yeah, Solar Swarm Recordings. It was great. It was a great idea at the time.
Yeah.
Lot of work.
I can only imagine. It was a lot of work. And Touchstone Recordings as well.
Yeah, Touchstone Recordings was the one I set up when I moved away from Solaris. But then the whole Pure Trance thing happened.
Yeah.
And I decided when the Pure Trance thing happened, I just wanted to focus on that rather than diluting myself between all these different things and being in all these different people.
And you stuck around. You stuck around. That's 11 years ago that you started Pure Trance. Yeah.
Yep.
And now Pure Trance Progressive just celebrated 200th release.
Unbelievable.
Pure Trance is about to hit the 300 mark as well. And Pure Trance Radio, 400 episodes.
I know, it's just these things, they go on and on, don't they? But I still love it. I love the whole Pure Trance thing, and I love the music I sign and that I release, and I genuinely, every track I release, I really, really love.
Yeah.
I don't, you know, I do it because I love the music. I definitely don't do it for the money.
Yeah. Yeah, I understand.
Definitely
that.
Not. I just love it. And with the day I stop loving the music, that's the day I'll just stop.
Yeah.
Do something else.
Well, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I want to ask, like, do you also feel like there's this new wave of trance coming? Because, like, the pure trance sound, that's basically what's coming back, right?
There's always something interesting happening in trance. And I think one of the, and we've got this sort of like hard trance, this super fast stuff happening, which I think is great. Artists like Part-Time Killer, for example. There's that. And now we have this new subgenre thing on Beatport. Because obviously, you know, everything trickles down from there, doesn't it? And John Fleming was instrumental in getting them to add this new raw slash deep slash hypnotic genre on Beatport. And now, because of that, DJs who previously would have shied away from playing anything labeled trance, now it's cool. You know, I play deep trance, I play hypnotic trance, I play raw trance, and the music that's in there, that's all the stuff that was languishing in the progressive house and melodic techno charts before. Yeah. So now we've got this new outlet.
It just didn't pop through because it was all mixed up with all the progressive house stuff.
Yeah, it was funny. Yeah. Like, I went to this rave and there was this guy coming out and he was like, I'm a DJ. And I'm like, oh, so what do you play? Like, techno music? And he was looking at me like, and he was like blushing and looking at me and he's like, I play trance music? And I'm like, oh, well, I work for State of Trance. Yeah. And he was like, oh, you like trance?
But
and
I just,
like,
yes. That's so funny that people still say it like that because...
How old is he though? What age was he?
He was my generation, so around 30, I guess.
So he's of the generation that are used to being
the Let's Go Milk Ink generation that were just
milk
afraid to.
Milk Ink generation.
No, they, because that's basically what certain people started calling trance, and that's why.
What did they call it?
Trance, Milk Ink, Let's Go.
Eurodance.
Yeah, Eurodance. Yeah.
And this is the thing: there's this kind of thing happening at the moment where a few big artists are making what they call classic trance.
But we like Calvin Harris, for example.
Yeah, but we know that it's not classic trance. It's Eurodance.
Yeah.
What we consider to be classic trance, pure trance music, it's still this. There's still a lovely scene bubbling away.
Yeah.
You know, it's just interesting, isn't it? I mean, I love it. When I do the radio show, when I go to Beatport and I browse, I can listen to the progressive house section. I can listen to the melodic techno section, organic house section, raw, deep, hypnotic trance sections. And I will find trance in all of those.
Yeah.
And this is brilliant, brilliant music. But it's funny because we're going on a bit of a loop, aren't we now?
Yeah.
Where it's almost becoming cool to say, I'm using classic trance melodies in my track. And I think that's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a ton of those artists right now that are also saying it. Like, for example, we have Ben Hemsley here in the studio and he's 20 something. And what you see right now, there's a whole wave of artists like him popping up that grew up listening to those old Amnesia sounds
in
or whatever.
In the car with their parents.
Yeah, they were listening to it. So they are inspired by what they were listening to in the past, sitting in the car of their parents, and they take those sounds into their productions right now.
What I'm less interested in is there's a couple of artists who do it very well, but this trying to make music that sounds like it was made then, I'm not a fan of that because we made music then to the best of our abilities, and that's why it sounded the way it did. And if we'd had all the equipment that you have now,
it would have been different.
We wouldn't have made it like that. So there's a few artists who do it well. Enigma State, obviously, he's the guy who does it really, really well.
Yeah.
But my favorite era in trance was the early 90s, the really hypnotic stuff. And those are the kind of the elements that I'm interested in bringing into my music. And I like it when I hear tracks from techno artists who are dipping their fingers into that era.
Yeah.
You know, the early stuff on Superstition and labels like that. That's really, really cool. I'm not interested in the whole Super Saw thing from 1999. Mm-hmm. I fucking hated that then, pardon my French. And I still don't like it now, you know.
No, but the thing is, like, you have to progress a genre. Like, you cannot, like, stand still, like, and look back. Because, like, in the end, obviously, there will be people who like that. And there will be young people who have never heard that sound. So they will be like, it's new. But in the end, as a producer, you want to progress. You want to progress a genre and not, like, stand still in what you're making, right? Yeah.
Forward forever, backward never.
Yeah.
It's, you know, you need to respect the past, and you can cherry pick what you want to use, but you have to be thinking about moving forward.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you just get stuck. I mean, pure trance, the whole pure trance thing was about the essence of the music and the community of it and the lifestyle kind of side of it. It wasn't really about the sound of it so much. That's why I've got so many sub-labels, because it's just about trance and not trying to be cool, not trying to use elements from house, not trying to use techno sounds, not trying to use dubstep sounds, just celebrating the fact that we love this music and being unashamed to fly the flag for it. That's what the whole Pure Trance thing was and is about.
Yeah, fair enough. And now the 10th edition of your album is out.
Yeah.
Lots of blood.
We've even done a vinyl
sweat
for
and
that.
Tears.
We've done a triple vinyl at the ridiculously reasonable price of €25.
Which, that is actually really cheap.
Yeah, that's really cheap.
I can believe it when Black Hole told me how much the price was. I was like, what?
Three vinyl?
Three discs.
Unbelievable.
For 25 years.
And the CD is really cheap as well, to be honest. So I'm not trying to say this, but it's like
I was looking on eBay on the way here to see if anybody was reselling their Pure Trance 10 CDs, and I found signed copies of Pure Trance 10 on eBay for £50. And it's still for sale in my shop.
It's still for sale, so you like just grab it. So that's the way to do it. Well, thank you so much for answering all these questions, Rich.
It's been a pleasure.
We're looking forward to see you in February for a State of Trance in Rotterdam, in the Ahoy.
Do you know Rotterdam Ahoy? That's where I first met Paula.
Really?
Aww.
Yeah, many, many years ago. I first met her. I'd been booked to play with Ferry at his...
The full-on Ferry.
That's right.
Masquerade.
And I met Paula that night for the very first time.
Was that? Did you play the one that he was...
Yeah,
like
in the spaceship.
Stage that, oh my Lord.
It was a nightmare. It was so hard to mix. He was like... I said, how am I going to mix? He's like, just mix in the headphones, Rich. I was like, I can't mix in the headphones. It was just guessing, really.
I remember that night. It was spectacular. That was actually one of the nights that really brought back memories when we announced Ahoy as the next location. I was like, oh, that was full of Ferry. Armin Only was there as well in 2000.
Yeah.
Seven or six, 2006.
I feel so young when you say this.
I'm really looking forward to going with Paula that night. We'll take the baby, we'll leave it with her mum, and we leave him with her mum, and we're going to go and we're going to recreate the first night we met.
Amazing. Yeah. Well, that's something very special then. Full circle.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
When was that? Oh my God. It was like 14 years ago or something like
At least. Well, once again, thank you so much for coming by, Rich Solarstone.
Thanks to both of you.
Any famous last words? Any last songs?
Any vocals?
just stop it now.
All right. Thank you so much for tuning in to this State of Trance podcast. See you for the next one. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. Check all previous episodes on YouTube or your favorite podcast portal.